It's Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Wisconsin began reintroducing elk to the Clam Lake area in 1995. Now the first managed elk hunt in the state's history is scheduled for this fall. First, students marched across the country and around the world over the weekend, protesting for school safety and stricter gun control laws. That includes at least 14 protests here in Wisconsin, with thousands of students taking to the streets on Saturday. Here's Olivia Smith, a sophomore at UW Oshkosh, who came down to Madison for the march.
I actually had to participate in a training on active shooters on campus, and it really opened my eyes to the fact that every day that I go to class, which I have to pay a lot of money for my education, that I'm pretty much risking my life, and you never know if you're going to be the next school, the next classroom that's targeted.
Wisconsin Public Radio's Lee Esther News Fellow Mary Lee Williams was covering the events in Madison. Mary Lee, thanks for being with us.
Yeah, I'm glad to be here.
This is the second large-scale protest organized by students since the shooting in Parkland, Florida. What did you see at the Wisconsin State Capitol this weekend?
I saw a lot of things that I thought were really interesting, and I think that when you said student-led, that's really important to highlight, is that this march and a lot of the, like, marches and organized events that have happened since the shooting at Parkland, they're all, a lot of them are student-led. And that really comes out in the mood and the just general feeling at the event. I thought there was a lot of really important, very like pressing issues that are discussed, gun violence, gun reform, you know, a voting, political activism. But the mood is that of hope and activism and determination. So, for example, There was a marching band there. It's like a social activism marching band in Madison. I can't recall the name.
I believe it's Forward Marching
Band.
Yeah,
Forward Marching Band. They were there, and it just transformed the kind of mood. There was music, and, you know, I wrote about this in my online copy, but at one point, one of the student organizers, Stephanie Trask, she joked about it, but she basically said, like, since we're teenagers, we have to take a selfie. And she got everyone in the crowd to lift up their signs, and they took a selfie. And I just thought that it was very aware of their age, was kind of joking about it, but also at the same time, it kind of captured the mood of determination. A lot of very serious topics were discussed, but it also was very hopeful and kind of fun.
And obviously there were supportive adults there as well as the students. And some of those adults were elected officials, including U.S. Representative Mark Pocan. Here he is speaking to the crowd.
No student should ever have to fear going to school and not surviving to the final period of the day. No parent should have to worry that sending their kid to school means sending them to their death sentence. No teacher or other school employee should have to go to work saying goodbye to their loved ones in the morning and have it actually be their final goodbye.
How did the young people especially react to what Representative Pocan had to say?
He had a lot to say, and I think that it's also important to bring up Senator Tammy Baldwin was also there. They kind of discussed a lot of the same things, but the reaction was overwhelmingly kind of positive. I think that a lot of what they talked about was how young people are leading the movement, how, you know, they talked a lot about the NRA. They did some condemning of the NRA. But ultimately, everyone reacted really positively. They were talking about how important activism is, and it just kind of captured the mood of the day. And, you know, I think that along with the representatives, a lot of students spoke, and they talked about their personal experience, which I find was a lot more emotional, a lot more personal, mm-hmm. and vulnerable, I think.
You mentioned voting as one of the elements that they were emphasizing. Were there people there registering people to vote?
Yes. At a lot of the events, there were events all over the state. Voting is a very big part of this because I think particularly for the students, a lot of these are high school and college students who are soon to be voting age or are, you know, have just started to be able to vote. And there were people there registering people to vote. They were walking around the crowd. And that's also like a big thing that they talked about too, is that for some of the high school students, I think Stephanie Trask, one of the organizers, I keep bringing her up because she brought up this thing, was like basically saying like, I can't vote. The only thing I can do is be an activist. The only thing I can do is march and speak. The adults can vote, and you're voting for me right now. Mm. You're voting. Like she said, like, it's my life on the line. That those kinds of things. I think that. So voting is a huge part of this, particularly with upcoming elections.
Mm-hmm. And Mary Lee, as we start to wrap up, did you get a sense of what plans there were to continue this momentum and to keep up the pressure that they're calling on?
They didn't specifically say any specific, like there weren't any specific events that they were bringing up that they were going to do. I think that the voting aspect is one way that I'm almost certain they're going to continue that. They talked a lot about voting. They talked a lot about political activism. And I think that for a lot of the students that were there who helped organize this, I don't see them slowing down anytime mm-hmm. soon. It seemed like while this event was, you know, it was across the country, it was huge, kind of a big pivotal moment in the movement. I think it's going to be interesting to see what's next, because to follow this march, I feel like it's going to take a lot of continued work, but they seem very determined.
Well, Mary Lee, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah.
Mary Lee Williams is WPR's Lee Esther News Fellow. She covered the March for Our Lives protest in Madison over the weekend. Haley B. Miller joins us now. She's a reporter with the Wausau Daily Herald and USA Today Network Wisconsin, and she covered protests in Wausau and Stevens Point. Haley, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We just heard about the protests in Madison. What was the scene like in Wausau on Saturday?
In Wausau, there were probably about 200 people who turned out, a mix of students and other residents. They gathered at the 400 block downtown and marched around there for a little bit. Then they marched to Congressman Sean Duffy's office, where they laid some roses at the door to commemorate the victims of the Parkland shooting and other school shootings.
And you were also in Stevens Point. What was going on there?
In Stevens Point, they marched from a parking lot to the university campus, and when they got to the campus, you know, it was probably about 100 people. They took turns speaking and sharing stories. Again, a mix of students and adult residents. There was one student who shared a personal story about her her father, who was killed by someone with a gun when she was 2 years old. So that was a pretty personal moment at that rally.
And Haley, when you say students, what kind of age range are we talking? I assume especially since it was on the college campus, that there were college students, but were there also high school or even younger students?
Yeah, the girl that I just mentioned who shared her story was 13. There were some college students as well, but also some high schoolers. I talked to a group of high schoolers from, I believe it was Wauwatosa, who were there, just kind of listening. They were there for, I forget what it was, but in any case, yeah. So definitely a range of ages.
And there, obviously, there was the commemoration aspect of this with, like you said, the roses for the victims in the Parkland shooting and other school shootings. What kind of points were the students specifically making about what kind of changes that they would like to see?
They are definitely advocating for tighter gun control laws. You know, one student I talked to in Wausau made the point that they don't want to take away every single gun that's out there, but they do believe that things like AR-15s shouldn't be available to the general public. You know, a lot of these students almost feel unsafe going to school right now, and, you know, I think they just want to see politicians exploring some, you know, tighter legislation to help certain people from getting these weapons.
students were a large part of these actions, but, you know, also supportive adults. Who actually organized these gatherings in Wausau and Stevens Point?
In Wausau, it was definitely in part organized by a couple high school students at Wausau West. I'm not sure who organized the rally in Stevens Point because I didn't speak directly with organizers there, but there were definitely, in Wausau at least, some students behind the orchestration of this event.
And what were you hearing from adults who were there?
You know, adults are similarly frustrated, I think, you know, wanting to see some more gun control measures. And, you know, I think, you know, some of these people were parents, too. And, you know, just they echoed a lot of what the students were saying. But, you know, in Wausau especially, there was really an effort just to make sure that these students' voices in particular were heard, because they are the ones being directly affected by these school shootings.
And as we wrap up, Haley, what did you hear about what they're planning next? Is this the end of something, or did you get a sense that it's more the start of something?
I definitely think this is just the beginning. I know in Wausau, at least, students are planning to orchestrate another walkout on April 20th, which is another kind of national date that students nationwide are adhering to, you know, the anniversary of the Columbine shooting. So students in Wausau, at least, are definitely planning something there. So it seems like, you know, these, they want to continue to make their voices heard and continue to raise these issues in their communities.
Well, Haley, thanks so much for spending time with us.
Thank you.
Haley B. Miller is a reporter with the Wausau Daily Herald and USA Today Network Wisconsin. She covered the March for Our Lives protests in Wausau and Stevens Point this weekend. Right now, you may have heard about the Department of Natural Resources announcement last week that Wisconsin will be hosting the first elk hunt in the state's history this fall after 23 years of reintroduction efforts. Kevin Wallenfang is the deer and elk ecologist for Wisconsin's Department of Natural Resources. Kevin, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Judith.
So tell us a little bit of the history of elk in Wisconsin. What happened to that original Wisconsin elk population?
Well, we need to go back a long way to do that. Historically, about 50 of Wisconsin's 72 counties have records of having elk in them. So elk were very common here at one time. And like happened with so many things across our landscape, as European settlement came to Wisconsin, primarily loss of habitat but also unregulated hunting, caused our elk population to disappear by the 1880s in our state. There were a few attempts over that time, primarily in the early 1900s, when lots of states were pulling elk out of the Yellowstone region to try to get elk back in their states. Wisconsin made that attempt, and it did not work. And then there was a resurrection of all this really from the grassroots level in the early 1990s, and that's when those elk from or in the Clam Lake area came out on the landscape. We were gifted 25 elk from the state of Michigan, and those were released in May of 1995 into Wisconsin.
And so those elk were brought to the Clam Lake area. For those not familiar with us, kind of place that for us on the Wisconsin map.
That is in the far northern part of the state. It's in Ashland County, so it's one of our far northern counties. And the elk range right now, for the most part, makes up pieces of Bayfield, Ashland, Sawyer, and Price County.
And it's, if I remember correctly, it's actually in or near the Shawamigan-Nicolet National Forest.
That's right. Most of the area that these animals spend time on is actually public land, and lots of folks go up there, you know, in the fall and throughout the year to look for elk and hear them bugling and things like that. So, you know, the benefits of having elk out there have been great.
I actually got to see them. I was up, I went up with Larry Mueller for a Bayfield and Bloom event, and on the way back home stopped and saw several pregnant cows, and it was a pretty amazing sight.
Yeah, they are a spectacular animal, and, you know, a lot of people are just happy hearing them in the fall. You'll hear the elk bugle, and that sound carries for a long way. It's how the males, you know, communicate with the rest of the herd, and it's just one of the most spectacular sounds in all of nature, in my opinion.
So 25 elk were brought here from Michigan in 1995. What numbers do we have today?
Well, today we're looking at, we actually have two elk populations in Wisconsin, and that herd up in the original Clam Lake area we are projecting is going to be well over 200 animals this year. And then we have the second herd down in Jackson County, which we started just a few years ago. Those elk came out of Kentucky, and that population right now is at about 55 to 60 animals.
And so we have the Clam Lake herd. We have the other herd that is new elk from Kentucky. Clearly partnerships with those states, but my understanding is that there are actually a lot of people and organizations involved in this effort.
Yeah, this whole project has really been, you know, I refer to it as a poster child of good partnership when everybody's got their mindset on one overall goal, and that goal was to bring a sustainable population of elk to Wisconsin. You know, this is how things happen. And we have had great partners financially. One of the biggest of those has been the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation, who are based out of Missoula, Montana. But we've also got, you know, a couple of different tribes in Wisconsin, the Chippewa tribes in the north and the Ho-Chunk Nation down in the Black River area, the Forest Service, county forests, state forests, other hunting and conservation groups in the state. It's really been a great situation. Everybody, you know, all wants the same things. They've been putting money into this, and we made commitments when this, you know, the last attempt was made here to bring elk out of Kentucky, that effort would be funded completely by private dollars. There would be no state money going into that. And those organizations that I've mentioned have put over $500,000 into bringing elk to Wisconsin.
We're talking with Kevin Wallenfang right now. He's a deer and elk ecologist for Wisconsin's Department of Natural Resources. And Kevin, what does it take to manage a herd? I mean, it seems to me that going from 25 to over 200 in a couple decades is a pretty big success story. What kind of management does that take?
Well, we feel it's a success story, but, you know, there's a lot of things that go into this that the general public normally doesn't see. A big part of it has been habitat work and just overall monitoring. You know, we know how these animals get by. We know what kills them. We know what helps them live. We know their birth rates and all kinds of things like that. And a lot of that is due to putting actual tracking collars on these animals. We've kind of evolved over the years with that as well. And we still use, it's called a VHF radio collar, and it actually requires you to go out. You've probably seen people do it or seen photographs of it with a little radio antenna in their hand or a big antenna on their truck, and they find the locations of all these animals. And then you can go in and you can analyze the type of habitat they're using or what they're eating or whatever it may be. And we've evolved now that we're actually putting GPS tracking collars on these things so that we get more readings on a daily basis. We can, you know, monitor them more tightly, and we can actually do that from a computer screen. We get computer mapping every single day and shows us exactly where these animals are. So doing that kind of work over the years has been very beneficial to us, and it's one of the things, of course, that leads into our opportunity to have a hunt because we can anticipate the type of birth rates. We know how many, you know, we expect somewhere in the neighborhood of about 45 calves to be born into that herd this year. And that's all because we know those animals, you know, we know how many adult cows of breeding age and things like that we have on the landscape. So that monitoring has been a real big part of it, but then also working with the habitat, trying to make it better so that those animals have more escape routes, more ability to evade predators or better cover to drop a calf in or whatever it may be.
Kevin, I think a lot of people might think, well, why have a hunt now? Why start this? Why not just let the herd continue to increase?
Yeah, and that's a fair question. You know, there was always intent to put these to have these animals provide a hunt someday. And, you know, this is the Department of Natural Resources, and we work to provide that hunting opportunity out there. But there are other things going on, and, you know, the monitoring that I was just talking about really helps us get a good picture of what's going on in those populations. And one of the things that obviously occurs when you have an elk reintroduction going on, you have more elk on the landscape, the more you have of anything out there, the more it requires management, the more it requires funding. One thing that is going to happen with this is that people will be required to either apply for a tag through the state drawing, or they can buy raffle tickets through one of those partners, the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation. And all of that money is earmarked for elk management in Wisconsin. So as we continue to try to grow the population, continue the research and the management that we're doing out there on the ground, that hunt is going to help, you know, to fund all of that. But another big part of what is going on out there right now is that we actually have some extremely old elk in the state. We actually have one of the original cows that was brought in from Michigan is still alive, so she's at least 23 years old. But we have some very old bulls out on the landscape, and we have a very high bull-to-cow ratio. So if you know something about how elk, the breeding process takes place, they actually gather harems. And very few of the bulls actually participate in the rutting activity. So there's a surplus of bulls out there right now, and that's, you know, that's like any hunting season. You have a surplus, and you set very tight regulations so that some of that surplus can be taken out without doing any kind of detrimental harm to the population. So we're at that point where we can finally do that. We've got tribal partners involved who have been very patient over the years waiting for their opportunity to hunt elk. It's a very big part of their culture. So there's kind of multiple things going on here. And but, you know, despite moving a small handful of animals from that population, we fully anticipate that someday we're going to get to our overall goal of 1,400 elk on the landscape up there.
Well, Kevin, thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That was Kevin Wallenfang, deer and elk ecologist for Wisconsin's DNR. He joined us to talk about the first ever elk hunt in Wisconsin, which is planned for this fall. First, we will all experience the death of a loved one at least once in life, and more likely many times. But the ways in which we relate to the dead and dying and the rituals that surround that transition can vary a lot. Kevin Tulis is a journalist, filmmaker, and author. His family has lived in the same village on an island off the coast of County Mayo for the last 200 years. And his new book is My Father's Wake, How the Irish Teach Us How to Live, Love, and Die. Kevin, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, Judith. Yeah, thank you very much for having me on the show.
Kevin, can you explain for those of us who haven't lived it what the Irish relationship to the dying and to death is?
Well, if you've never been to an Irish wake, you probably just think it's a few Irish drunks around a coffin. But you would be very much mistaken, because the wake is actually one of the oldest rites of humanity. It's mentioned in the Old Testament. It's mentioned in the Iliad, the poem that Homer wrote about the fall of Troy. And that poem was written in 800 BC. I mean, what the wake is it's a kind of ritual between obligations between the living and the dead. It's a form of sort of therapy, really, for where the mortal, the living, bond together in the face of the mortal. It's really the best lesson in life you could ever have, because there you have a dead human, one that you can reach out and touch, yet you're surrounded by your community, supported at often the worst moment of people's lives. That's what's so important about the wake.
You've experienced mortality and death in many ways throughout your life. Can you tell us about your hospital stay as a boy?
Well, what happened was I became a victim and a survivor of a very old disease, tuberculosis. Tuberculosis is a disease that has afflicted mankind for a million years. In the 19th century, in the industrial cities of across Europe and in America, one in four of the population died of tuberculosis. But it was actually a graduate student at Rutgers University in 1943 who discovered streptomycin, which was a kind of miracle cure. And around the world, in the Western world, certainly, tuberculosis began to die out. But in the 1970s, when I was still a child, I managed to contract that disease. But by that stage, all of the specialist tuberculosis hospitals, the sanitariums had closed down. So I ended up as an 11-year-old child being sent to what was effectively a lung cancer ward. And I spent a whole summer in a place that was pretty much a sort of antechamber to hell of men who were actually dying of lung cancer. Because at that particular time in the 70s, then the other epidemic of cancers related to tobacco use was actually at its peak. And so it was a fairly, I could say, shocking experience for a relatively young, naive child to be confronted with that. And I suppose, I mean, this is such a strange time if for your listeners, I mean, probably quite shocking, that the cancer ward did actually have a smoking lounge.
That was shocking to read.
Yeah, and then the nurses on their break would often go and sit in the smoking lounge along with the actual patients. And this was obviously, you know, several decades ago. So the actual kind of care that you would get, the drugs that we, you know, are around today, none of that was available. So in relative terms, the treatment for those lung cancers was fairly primitive. And your survival chances were very limited. Yet at the same time, some of the men on the ward had incredible dignity and incredible courage. And many of them were very kind to me as this sort of child passing through. And I look back on that, and from that ward, I am the only survivor. I mean, now time is long ago, but most of those men obviously died quite soon after I left that ward.
So you
and it was a place that, yeah.
I was going to say, you saw all of that as a boy. You also lost a brother early in life. And then you also came face to face with death as a journalist. And you say you were on a death hunt. Explain that for us.
Well, what happened was, even despite this experience, you know, when you're a young man of 18, 19, 20, or a young woman, you often are, you know, infused with a sense of immortality, that somehow this won't happen to you. But I had a brother who died when he was 26 after a battle with leukemia, and I was 20. And it did have a very profound effect on me. I mean, I suppose I was in a kind of strange sense of mourning, not really for my dead brother. I think more selfishly, you know, for myself, for the 20-year-old who I thought, you know, should have been immortal, but who knew now that he wasn't. So I ended up drifting into Northern Ireland's troubles as a reporter. And I developed, I'd say, an acute and dangerous gift, not something that you particularly want to develop, but I became very good at sort of getting into people's houses and within about 5 or 10 minutes asking them about the worst things that ever happened to them in their lives. And the reason why I did that was I wanted to know basically how you lived in the aftermath of mortality, how you struggled, how you could be brave in irreversible sorrow, how you could continue to go on after what other people would thought would be just a completely irretrievable loss. So I really went around the world asking those questions, hoping that someone would give me the answer.
And Kevin, you decided to write your book, My Father's Wake, How the Irish Teach Us How to Live, Love, and Die, focusing on that particular loss and that transition. What inspired you to really delve into the last months, weeks, days of your father?
Well, it's not really a transition. You know, my father died, as we all die, as mortals. And to be, you know, to be human is to be mortal, and to carry the burden of your mortality, and to help others in grace carry their burden, sometimes lightly and sometimes courageously. Now, all of my death hunting around the world never solved the problem of my mortality. But when I was back on the island, embraced by the Irish wake, my father was dying of pancreatic cancer, what I discovered really was the best way that we can face this as an individual mortal is to face it together, and that we don't really have to rediscover anything. We just need to go back to the Irish wake, which is this really ancient human rite. So when my father was dying, people came to see him because they wanted to say goodbye. They weren't embarrassed about his death, and he never flinched away from his impending death either. And the reason why he didn't do that is because he had grown up in the Irish wake tradition as a child. He'd been around the bereaved. He'd seen dead bodies. He'd seen dozens and dozens of dead bodies. His community treated death as it is, a very ordinary thing in life. There's an old Greek philosopher called Heraclitus who talks about the gods, and he says the gods are mortal and men are immortal, dying in each other's lives and living on in each other's death. And that is our perpetual story as humans.
And I think we lost Kevin, but we will get him back as soon as possible. Kevin Tulis is a journalist, filmmaker, and author. His new book is My Father's Wake, How the Irish Teach Us How to Live, Love, and Die. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. How intimately have you experienced death? Do the Irish traditions appeal to you, or is it too personal an experience of mortality? Does your family or your culture have particular death rituals that are meaningful to you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up that conversation after this short break. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Right now, we're continuing the conversation with author Kevin Tulis about his book, My Father's Wake, How the Irish Teach Us How to Live, Love, and Die. And we want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. Do you embrace death as a part of the life cycle, or do you prefer to keep it as distant from everyday life as possible? How much have you thought about how you'd like to be remembered and seen off? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Kevin, you talk about the Western death machine. What does that mean to you?
Well, really what's happened in the last two centuries in the Western world is through urbanization and medicalization that we basically separated the living from the dying. That, you know, ask your listeners, how often do you go to a funeral? How often, when was the last time you saw or touched a dead human, a dead one of us? I mean, I'm speaking to you from the close to the ruins of an old village, Dukanella on Achill Island, where my family are from, a village which was one of the, and still is one of the archives of the oldest faith of humanity. This belief in the Irish wake, in a kind of open acceptance of death. And, you know, our ancestors were basically far more comfortable around death than we are. And we often, the narrative is we see death as a sort of tragedy, an individual catastrophe, people go on all these runs against cancer and et cetera. But we don't visit the sick and dying. We have very little experience of what it is like for those around us to die, how we support them. How often do we go to funerals? Now, in the Irish wake tradition, you go a lot more often than we do in the Western death machine. And people are a lot more comfortable around death and dying and the bereaved. They don't feel embarrassed about, you know, crossing the office floor and shaking the hand of a colleague and saying, I'm really sorry about the death of your mother. Even it is a common American euphemism, but we talk about past and passing as opposed to what it really is. Dying and dead.
Let's go to our callers now. Jane in Sun Prairie is up first. Hi, Jane.
Hello. Thank you for taking me.
Of course.
My daughter was murdered as she left work on February 2nd of 2016. She was 24. And on the first anniversary, I planned to do some private things, and then it turned out that a vigil was planned. So I modified my plans, and I did a keening ceremony. I sang in Irish and English. I danced. We had music. And we took just like 2 gallons of holy water and poured it on the ground where she fell. And all kinds of people came forward, and we had our hands in it. We were washing the evil that happened on that spot away. And we sent her on her way.
Wow. Jane, I'm so sorry for your loss, and thank you very much for sharing that with us. Kevin, that reminds me of a lot that you wrote about in your book.
Well, it's important that we do have these rituals, that, you know, why we wake with the dead body through the night. It's like a wake is a bit like training for a marathon. If you knew that you were going to run a marathon, you had to run a marathon, and the whistle went off, and there was no warning, or someone who you loved had to run that marathon, then it would be a really good idea to have a few practice laps to see what it's like, to see how other people are like in that situation, to know what to do. You know, we practice to learn how to drive. We practice to learn a foreign language. Going to the Irish wake is like a little bit of practicing about what it is to be mortal.
Thanks again for that call, Jane. Let's go next to Molly in Brookfield. Hi, Molly.
Hi. I just wanted to say I think it's very important that when a person is facing their own mortality, their own death, that those around them who give support, they need to listen to them. Because I know when my sister was dying of cancer, she so badly wanted to talk about her death, but nobody would do it. I did. I finally sat down and did it with her, but everybody kept saying, "You're going to beat this. You're going to beat this. We're not going to talk about a funeral. We're not going to do this." But it was important, and she needed to have that conversation, as hard as it was, but I had to do it.
That's a great point, Molly. And Kevin, there is something that this isn't just for the people who are going to survive this. It's also for the person who's dying. How did your father respond as his end was coming?
Well, my father, you know, was quite stoic about it because he had experience of this by going to Irish wakes himself, and being his community had obviously gone through this experience many, many times before. Now, you are allowed to deny your death. You know, you're allowed in that personal circumstance. But one of the things my father, Sonny, taught me, the last parental lesson of all, is you have to teach your children how to die. Yeah, it may sound really strange, but of course, that is the endless human story. It's not that we've just suddenly become, you know, this particular generation have discovered death. It's always kind of funny how teenagers, you know, rediscover sex and are both embarrassed and thrilled by it. But we somehow do the same about death. Somehow we think, my goodness, it's like we're the first generation that have died. But of course, we are the 100,000th human generation who've died. And we just need to take those lessons of the past and the wisdom of the past with us.
Molly, thank you for that call, and I'm sorry for the loss of your sister. Catherine in Milwaukee is up next. Hi, Catherine.
Hello. Yes, my experience and my personal belief about death is that the body dies, but the consciousness, the spirit, goes on. And from everything that I've experienced in my life and have learned about, I really believe that when the person leaves their body, their soul, they're greeted by loved ones from the other side. There's so many people that have gone through near-death experiences. And I've experienced my own father's death and recently the death of an ex-husband of mine. And I know and feel that they are, first of all, relief from their pain. Secondly, greeted by loved ones. And spiritually, they are going on to keep learning and growing in their consciousness, keep evolving, because the body is only a shell, and the spirit and soul goes on always.
Thank you very much for sharing that, Catherine. And Kevin, does that resonate with you?
Well, I disagree with the idea that the body is a shell. It's very important. Our ancestors, you know, spend a lot of time caring for the bodies of the dead. And I think that's really important too. It's really important that we actually see and touch our personal dead, that it's not just, they're not something that's unimportant. and the reverence, like in the Iliad, there's a sort of famous scene in it where the Trojan king, he goes to rescue his son Hector, and people say, oh, don't go there, the Greeks are going to kill you. And he says, I don't care if they kill me, as long as I have the heart-comforting embrace of my dead son in my arms. And so the bodies of our dead, of those that we love, are hugely important. And our ancestors obviously lavished huge amounts of love and attention, caring for those bodies and making sure that they went off to the afterlife with as much care and dignity as possible. And we still fundamentally believe that it's important that people are given a proper burial. It's just that we've somehow shied away from the physicality of the dead. And I think that's something that we need to rediscover, the physicality of seeing and touching your beloved dead.
Thank you for that call, Catherine. I want to make sure we have time for Carol in Racine before we run out of time. Hi, Carol.
Hi. My name is Carol. I live in Racine. I try to look for comfort. I just lost my son a month ago, and it's not easy. He was only 48 years old. I know he was in a lot of physical pain. We don't know what he died from. He had his pajamas on. He died sitting in a chair, and he keeled over. He just flopped over. And I just talked to him on the phone at 9:30 that night on a Monday night. And by Tuesday morning, they called me and said, come down to the office. We want to talk to you. They told me, the coroner said, your son is dead. I said, no, he's not. It's very, very hard.
Carol, I'm so sorry for your loss and that it's so recent and fresh for you. And Kevin, you know, kind of going back to what you were saying, you know, having that real sense of community and that you're not in it alone. I feel like that's part of what we have lost in the West with being kind of arm's length from death and dying.
Well, I'm sorry for your loss, Carol, too. And I think that is the point, is that we carry the burden more lightly by having more hands. And the more open and honest that we are, the fact if we participate in these rituals, once in our own family, but if we reach out to our neighbors, is it really simple? Is that you hear of someone, maybe a work colleague who's sick or dying, and instead of sort of shunning them and thinking, oh, they won't want any kind of contact, just make an attempt to reach out, you know, call them, go round to see them, offer to help. If you're actually the person who's doing the dying, this may sound strange, but try and share your death. Ask for help, because what you're doing is something that's incredibly kind of human. Dying is a really exhausting process, and you're going to need help. And if you think about it, the one first best hope of humanity is that you will be born in a community who will love you. And we think it's terrible for a child who's born to parents who don't love him or community or her. The last best hope.
Thank you so much for joining us, Kevin, and spending time with us. Kevin Tulis is a journalist, filmmaker, and author. His family's lived in the same village on an island off the coast of County Mayo for the last 200 years, and he joined us to talk about his new book, which is titled My Father's Wake, How the Irish Teach Us How to Live, Love, and Die. Last month, we talked about a proposal that was part of the draft budget bill that would have allowed owners and managers to decide how tips should be distributed, or even to take a cut themselves. We thought it was worth an update, since that was addressed in the omnibus spending bill that was signed into law on Friday. The spending bill makes it clear that management cannot take tips from service employees, although in some circumstances, it does allow for tipping of back-of-house employees to be mandated. But that's only if all all employees are making minimum wage. Right now, most wait staff make a much lower minimum. Finally, the bill also gives tipped employees more recourse if their tips are withheld or stolen. So just an update there on the tipping situation. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and WPR, and then we'll take a look at what else is in the $1.3 trillion omnibus bill President Trump signed on Friday. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.